I first heard about Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim, I think on your Facebook page, and my immediate thought was one of the seven deadly sins, envy, because I thought, oh, what a great title. I wish I had thought of that.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 420, Satan Sings Sondheim. In March of 2014, the not late but definitely lamented Adam Long wrote and performed in a new musical cabaret called Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim. And this month, Adam's script is being published in the Sondheim Review alongside a Q&A I conducted with Adam at the request of Russell Denbin, the associate editor of the Sondheim Review. So here now is the full conversation I had with Adam Long about his script, Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim, and how he wrote it, and about the nature of Sondheim and evil.
What made you think of that title, Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim?
There was a woman named Barbara Cook who came over here a few years back and did a show called Barbara Cook Sings Mostly Sondheim. And being huge Sondheim fans, we went to it, and it was great. There, she says she sang mostly Sondheim, but it wasn't mostly Sondheim. It was mostly other things. And then also, she had this little bit of a, she was an older, she was a more mature woman, and she had a little bit of a growl in her voice when she sang, and we kept, and the growl kept coming back over and over again. And after a while, I just turned to Alex and said very quietly, they should have called this Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim. And then that just sort of stuck in our head, and we ended up staying awake until like, God, it would have been like 3 a.m. that night. We just couldn't go to sleep because we kept thinking about the idea of Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim. We just thought it was such a great idea. Somebody's got to do it. I actually wrote down like all of the notes from that night and then just kept them in my computer thinking that there would be no real world application for them. How wrong I was.
Indeed, how wrong you was. And in most of your writing work, you are reducing or abridging or condensing or shortening large topics. And here you are expanding a one-line joke.
Yeah, well,
what was the difference?
Okay, we realized right away that we had to make it more than one joke. So we just started thinking about the characters, you know, and I think the first thing we did was actually sit down and figure out, okay, well, who are the characters and what do they want? And it was, you know, we didn't think it had to be terribly complex. We knew Satan wanted to get the rights to sing Sondheim's shows. And this would be like the ultimate underdog story because Satan would be the last person in the world that Sondheim would be likely to grant rights to. So it was a good dramatic setup, but then you had to think, well, why does Satan want the rights to sing the shows? And we just thought, well, he's a song and dance guy. You know, he's been in musical theater all his life. You know, he could have been living in hell for all his life, but he was very excited about what was happening in musical theater, and he came to Earth. And ever since then, he's had a very successful career, and, you know, he played the Artful Dodger and in Oliver, and he's been in Chorus Line, and he's had the sort of career that you would expect that somebody should be very happy with. But the one thing that he's never done is Sondheim. And then Sondheim is sort of synonymous with artistic credibility, isn't it? So it's like this idea that you haven't really arrived until you've done Sondheim. You know, the commercial success means nothing. Artistic credibility means everything, and you can't feel as if you've had artistic credibility if you've never done Sondheim. So basically we thought this is a big deal for this character. You know, it's not just a casual thing. This is like the pinnacle of his life's work is to actually perform this. And then we started thinking, there were certain constraints that we had to work within because the German Street Theater is a very, very small theater, so there wasn't going to be a huge amount of income. So we knew we had to keep it really, really small. So we decided we'd just do it as two actors and a pianist. So, you know, we figure, well, the other actor has to be Satan's agent who's got the unenviable task of trying to secure these rights. And then we thought, well, the agent, you know, then we had to think of, well, who is this agent and why is he doing what he was doing? And we kind of thought that the agent would be somebody who had been an actor as well. Because, Austin, you know, my dad was an actor. So
yeah, I did that.
So, yes, he was like a Hollywood actor. So I got to see what it was like to be an actor. And it's a pretty difficult way of life. You know, you're going to fail more auditions than you're going to get. And some actors stick it out and some don't. We reckon that Satan's agent, who we called Robert Schifrin, was an actor who just couldn't hack all the rejection. And so he'd actually chucked acting and he'd become an agent, although he had sort of like, he still somewhere deep in his soul wanted to be an actor himself. But Robert Schifrin's a bit besotted with Satan, and he really wants to come through for, he really believes in Satan. He really believes that Satan has something to offer, and he really wants to get Satan this gig and make Satan happy. So those were our two guys. And we thought that, you know, it's just a very simple story. They want to get this theater. They want to do Sondheim's work. Sondheim won't grant them the rights. They think of everything they can to turn Sondheim around, and well, I don't want to give it away for anyone who wants to read the script.
Yeah, no, keep the spoilers. Well, it's just a funny idea on so many levels that Satan, the Prince of Darkness, would crave artistic respectability and credibility. How much, when I first heard of it, again, I thought, this is a theatricalization, this is an update of C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters. Instead of writing diaries and letters, he's a song and dance man. Did C.S. Lewis and Screwtape enter into your creation of the character or your thought of what the piece could do?
Absolutely. I have been in my time a huge C.S. Lewis fan. And in fact, at university, I even took a course in C.S. Lewis and his theology. And I was very interested in all of that. And in Screwtape Letters, like Satan and his demons are all bureaucrats, aren't they? And they sort of like sit in their office and come up with ways of tempting people. So in that respect, it's sort of similar in as much as we're bringing the whole concept of Satan into a more mundane level. And the thing is, I had always thought of Satan as like the embodiment of evil. But when I sort of researched it a little bit more, it's actually more temptation. Satan is the tempter, which I thought fits very, very well with the theme of Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim, because it's this idea of like desire. And sometimes people's deepest desires, they don't even question them. They could just be a stupid thing, you know, like you don't even second guess why you've got this deep drive down inside to do something. You just have it and you just go for it. You know, crazy people who go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Why do they do that? I don't know. There's just something there. So, and especially I see this a lot with actors, you know, they've just, I gotta work. I've got to do this job. I've got to do this. It's like, why is it, you know, and with Satan, it's like, you're Satan. You're the king of the underworld. You know, you've got supernatural powers and yet you've got this sort of gnawing void inside you that you won't feel complete unless you do the works of Sondheim.
You're right. And as you say, that matches up with so many great musical theater characters, many of whom are Sondheims.
Yeah. But you know what? Another theme that we really got into with this is very, very early on, I started thinking about, okay, what Sondheim songs would we want to pastiche? Because we knew that we didn't have the rights to do any actual songs by Sondheim. So that had to be sort of woven into the script, this idea that we can't in the theater perform any works by Sondheim. So Satan can't either. But we can still sort of pastiche some of his songs. So what do we want to do? So there's a song at the end of Sunday in the Park with George called Move On. And that George, the young artist, just feels that he has nothing to say. And then his great-grandmother, his great-great-grandmother comes to him and says that you have a lot to say, you have a lot to give. And we thought, well, that's got to be it for Satan at the end. It's like, you know, you've got to express what's in you, not just sort of try to redo works that other people have already done. And I especially think in musical theater, that's a good message to send out, because so much musical theater these days is revivalism, either taking a movie that's already been written and reimagining it as a musical, or to take the back catalog of a pop band and reimagine it. But where are the new musicals? You know, this is the thing that we should really embrace, is this idea that, like, people actually have something unique to themselves that they can express. It doesn't have to be just reviving old people's stuff. And so this is sort of the journey that Satan goes on, is by the end learning that he has something valuable to express. He doesn't have to do Sondheim.
It's so fun that unlike Screwtape and the bureaucrats of hell, your vision is not the banality of evil. Your vision is the fabulousness of evil.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Howard Sherman, noted theatrical pundit and raconteur, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSE? Starting next month in January 2015, you'll have 5 months to see us perform the complete history of Comedy Bridge in 70 cities across the UK and Ireland. Plus, there'll be assorted dates in the US and more dates coming soon. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader or email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe, and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information.
So while you were, yes, you were expanding this joke, but at the same time, you were sort of getting to the reduced, abridged, condensed, shortened gist of Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to touch on, you know, sort of, I mean, I love the world of musical theater, and my introduction to musical theater was through Sondheim. Like, I started off by going to the Donmar Warehouse with Alex and seeing these Sam Mendes productions of Sondheim's work. And I thought that all musical theater was like this. And of course, it isn't. But I didn't know that at the time. But still, I think very highly of Sondheim. And so a lot of it has to do with musical theater, with Sondheim's place in musical theater. Questions of, like, artistic credibility. You know, like at one point, Satan's trying to get... He's trying to get the rights from Sondheim, and Sondheim's on the phone with him, and he just flatly refuses. And Satan says, you know, curses, my satanic powers are no match for his artistic credibility.
Which is a great moral right there.
I know. It's like, you know, what would it take to get somebody to... I heard a great story about Woody Allen once, that, like, at one point some accountants just sort of basically sat down with him and said, look, if you tack a happy ending onto one of your movies, we can guarantee you that it makes... you know, $2 or $3 million more at the box office. Like, how do you, as an artist, fight against sort of commercial considerations and stay true to your artistic vision? You know, because it's like there's a difference between giving an audience what they want and therefore what you know is going to make money for you. And then on the other hand, with your Sondheim, it's that whether or not you make money doesn't seem to be a driving force with him. So Satan doesn't actually have a lever to, you know, no amount of money or satanic powers or anything that Satan uses are going to be a match for Sondheim's artistic integrity.
how much of your creation of the character of Satan was informed by the fact that you were also going to be acting it?
Yes. Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but I think a lot of that show... was based on my dad, you know, so it really was coming right out of me. There was a little bit of my dad in there. There was a lot of Woody Allen in there, because I'm very much a Woody Allen fan, especially his earlier, funnier films. So that was like, okay, he's in New York. He was probably born in Rockaway Beach or something like that. He's definitely from another era, you know, and because I knew I was going to be playing it, I knew that Satan had to be born in the early 1960s. which luckily was a golden age in the world of musical theater, because there was Fiddler on the Roof and I can't even remember what all the different musicals were that were bopping around back then. I think Oliver was around then, and
West Side Story and The Music Man. I just happened in the late 50s, and funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. was 62, I
so,
think.
So yeah. Definitely the fact that I was going to play him meant that the age of Satan was going to be my age, that Satan's backstory was going to be like my dad's backstory, that that sort of like the sense of humor, sort of like the mannerisms of Satan were going to be a little bit sort of Woody Allen-ish. So it had it was basically just building it around me. And also I knew very early on that Mark Cavan was going to be playing the part of Robert Schifrin. So we started like sort of basically writing the parts to fit me and Mark.
I used to work, because I did the BMI Music Theater Workshop a generation ago. And my composer partner at the time used to argue that Sondheim destroyed a generation of musical theater writers who stopped trying to find their own voice and wanted to try to copy his. And I think that's a very kind of a valid point, but also that seems like a kind of a theme of what you're talking about, that Satan wants to be Sondheim so badly, or he's not being true to his own self.
Yeah. Yeah. Although that's not really Sondheim's fault. And,
no,
and in the same
not.
Way,
yeah.
And in the same way, Satan is always in our show. As we get into the second half of the show, we get a little bit more into theology, and they're talking about how there's all this prejudice against Satan because he created evil, and Satan protests and says, "I don't create evil; people create evil." And it's the same sort of thing with Sondheim, you know. I mean, Sondheim was writing what was true to him, and then loads of other people came along and tried to imitate that.
Right. How is that my fault? So you really are equating Satan with Sondheim. Well done.
We're exploring themes. Actually, you know, one of the things that I think that so much writing nowadays in like the post-Michael Eisner world of high concept is about like zeroing in on things. But with Sondheim's work, he seems to riff a lot more and to explore themes. You know, something like, you know, Into the Woods, it's almost like he starts off by establishing a premise in Act One, and then it's sort of like broadening out and seeing how he can explore it in different ways. And I kind of, you know, in some ways, there were just so many themes we could have looked at with Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim, but ultimately it was only going to be 60 minutes. We tried to get into as many different themes as we could, but we needed to keep it a show that had a beginning, middle, and an end, was 60 minutes
right.
long, and was entertaining.
Well, and I think it works as it's. I expected more of a review in a kind of company style in the style of Stephen Sondheim's Company, but it it really felt more like Follies.
It was good.
Yeah, you know, it's a kind of a overview of this character. How did you approach did you write the pastiches, and how did you approach writing them?
Yeah, I knew what songs I wanted to do. So we knew that we wanted to end the show with a pastiche of Move On. I thought that the best possible opening for a show that you could have was the opening from Follies, the Something Appealing, A Comedy Tonight, I think it's called. So I knew
yeah,
we
from
wanted,
Forum. It's from Forum.
Yeah, funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. And so we knew we wanted to start with that. We would just see Merrily We Roll Along, and there's that Franklin Shepard Inc. song where the telephones ring and the buzzers buzz, and you know, what it was. And we thought, okay, that would be great for like Satan's I Want song, you know. So we knew that had to be like in the first third of the show is Satan singing All I Want is the Rights to Stephen Sondheim's Work. So we knew it was that kind of almost like a patter song. So I picked out all of the songs,
right.
And then I wrote lyrics that sort of would fit with that particular song. And then our musical director, Joe Chachanska, came along, and she was a massive, we met a couple of potential musical directors, but she was just like the biggest Sondheim head. I think she'd done Sweeney Todd as her dissertation at university, and she had the sheet music of every Sondheim musical ever written. And so I just basically wrote lyrics, and I knew how I wanted the lyrics to sit in the music, and then Joe wrote all of the music. And we just sort of did it as we rehearsed for the most part.
Cool.
We had one session where we went over to her place and sat around her grand piano. But then for the rest of the time, she was actually in the rehearsals coming up with the music right then and there.
Can you imagine ever performing this show with Stephen Sondheim in the audience?
Yeah, I think I definitely could perform the show with Stephen Sondheim in the audience. I think it's very respectful of Stephen Sondheim. And we were a bit nervous when the members of the Sondheim Society came to the show, because we thought, well, if anyone's going to take offense, it's going to be these people. But I think people really recognize that it's, it is respectful to him. So I think I probably could perform it with Sondheim in the audience. Now, how the audience would react on a night where Sondheim was in the audience, God, I can't even imagine.
Well, that's right. I mean, they wouldn't react at you. They'd look at Stephen Sondheim, like when the Queen is in the audience.
Yeah, exactly. There's one point in the show where Satan gets, he's on the phone with Sondheim and he gets fed up with Sondheim and he just says, I think you suck, Stephen Sondheim. And I can just see, like, on the night that Sondheim's in the audience, every head in the auditorium just turning to look at him and see what his reaction is. I think Sondheim himself would probably like the show. I think the more important question is, what would Sondheim's lawyers make of the show? That's what we were... This was the first show... I mean, when we talk about the writing process, this is the first show I've ever worked on where the first thing the producer did was go to a lawyer. Before I even put pen to paper, a lawyer was consulted, and we came back with a whole list of directions of this is what you can do, this is what you can't do, this is what you can get away with in the UK, this is what you probably can't get away with in the UK. So I had to like write with this lawyer's brief in front of me, and also, when I was about two-thirds of the way through with the script, we started getting these frantic phone calls from first Michael Callahan, our music publisher, saying that Stephen's people had gotten in touch with him and they wanted to get a hold of me, so they were getting a hold of him, and that Steve wanted to see a copy of the script immediately. And I said, well, I haven't written it yet. And they thought I was just using that to sort of stall them or something like that, but I really hadn't written it yet. Then the owner of the theater contacted us and said that Cameron McIntosh's people had gotten in touch with him because Stephen's people had been in touch with them, and could they find out something about this Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim show? So it was like this mad scramble to get a copy together as quickly as possible. I mean, the whole thing, the whole script, I think, was written in 3 weeks.
Right.
And we had to have a copy of it on Stephen's desk at the end of that three-week period.
Very good.
And so we did, and then Sondheim thanked us for sending him the script, and we never heard anything from him again. So we assume that he loved it and thought it was the greatest piece of work that had ever come across his desk.
I think that's probably a fair assumption.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. You can read Adam's script for Satan Sings Mostly Sondheim by buying this month's issue of the Sondheim Review at sondheimreview.com. Just order the spring 2015 issue. There you will also find an edited excerpt of this Q&A. Send us your Q's and A's, if you have them, via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews of this podcast on iTunes. You can interact with other fans on our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, the baker's wife Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Paul Harmon. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to the blonde lady who threw me the ear-tug gookie from the audience at last Wednesday night's performance of The Complete History of Comedy Abridged at the Marin Theatre Company, but then who didn't say hi at the table afterwards, unfortunately. Thanks also to Russell Dembin, associate editor of the Sondheim Review, for asking me to do this. Thanks also to Howard Sherman, who, in addition to everything else, recommended me for the Q&A gig, apparently. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 420 1260ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Is there an album?
I'd love there to be an album. I don't know. Basically, I mean, really, we only stopped performing it at the beginning of April, so it's only really been a few months, and I think everybody's still sort of recovering from it. We're just kind of stunned that we really did it. You know, it seemed like such a ridiculous thing. When it was first mooted, I thought it was just a joke. I didn't think it was really going to happen. And so I think it's going to take a little bit of time for everybody to sort of recover from it and think about, does this actually have a future, or was this just something that we did for a laugh and thank God that we got away with it without being sued?
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.